Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned into The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and all that nasty selfishness went wrong, and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us to each other, no matter what we find to squabble over in the interim. Now, you can call us toll-free from the U.S. to 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada to 888-810-8322. Or you can call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for the show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as is humanly or even extra-humanly possible on the station archives. And now, my personal blog is located at howtheneoconstolefreedom.blogspot.com, and I bet you can't tell what it's about. My blog at the top this week is What Osama Bin Laden, George Bush, GE, and Tammy Faye Baker Have in Common. The article goes straight to our subject for tonight, so check it out. Interesting developments in presidential pageant land. Richard Viguerie, the guru of fundraising who did so much to put those now in power where they are, issued an open letter to his fellow conservatives. I'll read this delicious little write in its entirety. Let's have a real debate on foreign policy and the Iraq war. My fellow conservatives, are you fed up with politics as usual, including poll-driven sound bites crafted behind closed doors by the for-hire political marketing professionals? These do not add up to any understanding of the issues at stake. The American people deserve better. We are not buying a bar of soap. We want real debates on issues of importance. Let's start now by challenging Rudy Giuliani and Ron Paul to a one-on-one debate on American foreign policy and the Iraq War. These are crucial issues that deserve in-depth discussion. It's obvious from the Republican presidential debates held so far that these two candidates have strong feelings but divergent opinions about these vital issues. Both of them are knowledgeable and articulate on the subject. They have the capability to recreate the famed Lincoln-Douglas debates on the foremost issue of our day. Let's do it. Cordially, Richard A. Viguerie. Since we all know perfectly well that old Richard must have been sniggering when he included both candidates as being, quote, knowledgeable and articulate on the subject, we can now imagine what such a debate would be like. The Ron Paul breakout continues, leaving the other nine Republican candidates looking like disoriented Ken dolls with broken talking strings. Tuesday, the largest contingent of support for a candidate came out for Ron Paul, and some of those came from many states away. The Freedom Ride, the RV that's following Dr. Paul around, was out in power collecting stories and making freedom visible on even more horizons. Tucker Carlson has invited Ron on his show to give a series of tutorials. Somehow I doubt that Rudy will be asked to do so much, but perhaps he could give Tammy Faye Baker some advice on her makeup. That sequence is available online. Now, here's a quote from the Tucker Carlson show. It's sort of strange that they'd call me eccentric and strange when I defend the Constitution, said Paul. But I think that's the point where we've gotten to, where defending the Constitution is a little bit different. Dr. Paul went on to say, I think the party is in shambles. I'm considered pretty conservative, and yet they think that I don't fit in. And I've even been asked to leave the Republican Party. But they won't admit that the foreign policy is flawed and that the war is the real issue. And if they don't admit that, I don't see how they can come up with a candidate that's going to be electable. Carlson concluded with, amen. I hope you can come on regularly just for a tutorial on what it means to be free. And now our comments for the week ahead. Today is the 40th anniversary of the attack on the USS Liberty. This outrage remains largely invisible to Americans even today. But the willingness of Israel to conspire to murder American military and destroy an American vessel is something that Americans must take very seriously, especially given the number of people now serving in this administration who hold dual citizenship, American and Israeli. This was carried out to incite anger in America towards Egypt, some say, and exactly parallels other actions carried out by Israel, including the use of film to create the impression that Palestinians rejoiced when the Twin Towers fell. There's a principle in law that if someone proves demonstrably that they cannot be trusted or tell the truth, then you assume they're lying. Today, all Americans must assume that Israel lies as a matter of policy. No one holding Israeli citizenship should be trusted or in a position of trust. All those holding dual citizenship should either give it up or leave immediately. As I mentioned earlier, my blog article is about Palestine and the linkages that make that an extension of a larger story that's now binding Americans to what threatens to be a perpetual servitude. The following is from a personal story retold for publication by one of our guests tonight, Tammy Watts. Don't shoot, there's an American in the back. The frantic cry of my taxi driver pierced the air. Our vehicle had come to an abrupt halt as an Israeli soldier jumped from behind a piece of corrugated metal. His M16 was leveled at the rear window a few feet from my head. There's an American in the back. He checked his weapon and demanded my passport. Aloof, I handed it to him without making eye contact. I was too angry to be scared. He thumbed through it and returned it, motioning us to continue. I wonder what might have happened if there hadn't been an American in the back. It wasn't even a checkpoint, I muttered as I looked over the brown rocky hills surrounding Bethlehem. We continued to the ruins of Herodium, a palace fortress built in 24 BC by King Herod. Each bend in the road introduced sweeping vistas of fields and more rolling hills, stretching in every direction. I imagined this landscape hadn't changed much since Jesus walked here. Too bad I was out of the mood for sightseeing. Now, this is the way Palestinians live every day of their lives. Our guests today are Tammy Watts and Colonel David Antoon. You met the Colonel last week. David is a graduate of the United States Air Force Academy and served nearly three tours of duty in Vietnam. During his tours of duty in that war zone, he received three Air Medals, the Distinguished Flying Cross, and the Meritorious Service Medal. He retired from the Air Force in the early 90s and now flies a 747 for a major airline. He's received two graduate degrees and has lived in the Middle East and has traveled extensively around the world. His last job before retiring was oversight of part of the construction of the B-2 bomber. Tammy Watts is a journalist who's traveled and lived in 41 countries across the world. She's presently working on a book about Palestine. Her own blog with her articles on the embattled nation can be read at commonsensefromthecornfield.blogspot.com. Genocide is a ugly reality. Nothing about what is going on in our world today is beautiful. But at least now Americans are starting to wake up and fight back. Please welcome Tammy Watts and David Antoon. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks so much for joining us today. I know that we're going to have a lot to talk about. There's a lot happening. And, of course, today as the 40th anniversary of the USS Liberty, there's a lot of things that Americans really should become conscious and aware of. And, of course, I'm newer to this subject, and the two of you, this is something that you've both been studying for many years. So why don't we start out with the USS Liberty, since it's the anniversary. And, you know, David, could you tell us exactly what happened?
Well, in 1967, the Israelis attacked the USS Liberty, which was off the coast of Egypt. And they surveyed the ship about 8 o'clock in the morning, and by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they had a full-blown attack, including the use of napalm bombs and other weapons. One of the tragic parts of this attack, which is just now coming out, at least I just heard about it in today's newspaper release, which again, we rarely see in the U.S. newspapers, was that the Israelis attacked 3 lifeboats with some of the most wounded sailors from the USS Liberty. They were not going to have any witnesses or survivors of this attack on the USS Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
It was blatant murder, and in military customs, it is really despicable that you would, after you've sunk a ship or attempted to sink the ship, then you would attempt to murder the surviving crew members. Our Congress has never called for an investigation of this event. There were pressures put on President Johnson to prevent it from ever becoming knowledge to the American people. I noted in the readings today that there were 2 Israeli pilots who refused to attack the USS Liberty because they knew it was an American ship and were jailed for 18 years.
Oh, heavens.
Yeah. Also, in contrast, when you look at, and there's so many contrasts when you consider the dual standard when it comes to Israel. If you look at the attack by North Korea on the USS Pueblo, the attack on the USS Stark, the attack on the USS Cole, the downing of the aircraft in the China Air incident, it's amazing that the USS Liberty event has been silenced for 40 years. Today is the 40th anniversary, and I think we need to take this date, this anniversary, as a time to bring this event into the public eye.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the men that served on it, the ones that died, one of the things that I noticed was that they didn't even note how they died. Reading their tombstones, you would have thought that they were killed in, that they had died of disease or something.
Correct. Yeah, they said died. They did not say killed. There were 34 U.S. seamen killed and 171 who were injured out of a total crew of 297. The captain of the ship was awarded the Medal of Honor, Commander McGonagall. However, it was done in a very low-key event and not in the White House where every other Medal of Honor has been awarded. Everything about this event was hidden from the American public.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was going on in the world at that time? Because obviously this wasn't a mistake, this was a matter of policy by Israel.
Right. There's a lot of... the history shows that... of course, there's so much revisionist history in the books, but at that time, Israel was attacking Egypt, and they all had plans to take over the West Bank. They had plans to attack the Golan Heights, and the USS Liberty was an intelligence ship, and it was gathering information. It had real-time transmissions bouncing off the moon, which was pretty modern at that time,
mm-hmm.
and the transmissions, the Israelis must have known that this information was getting out, and they wanted no one in the world to know that this was a preemptive attack on Egypt and later Syria. In fact, they held off the attack on Syria until they completed the attack on the USS Liberty.
So if you actually take a timeline and you show the progression of events for what we all thought of, I mean, I certainly, this is what I had heard at the time, and I never had known different until recently. What you had was Israel actually attacking its neighbors and not its neighbors attacking it.
Correct, correct. Tammy probably has much more information on this than I do.
Tammy?
Yes.
Tell us about that. What do you
think? it's a mistaken concept that that you know Israel was responding to a threat from Egypt and Syria and everything. This has been used repeatedly by administrations throughout history since the event to portray the event as Israel was defending its right to exist. You know, we've been hearing that. It's become like a mantra in our media. You know, you hear about Israel's right to exist, Israel's right to exist. When you hear accounts of this event, it's about, you know, Israel was facing annihilation at the time. These Arab armies were massed on her borders and this and that. The fact is that the Egyptians didn't even come into Israeli territory because there were no tanks, there were no soldiers or anything killed with or found with on the Israeli side of the border, and which proves right there that it was not an invasion, it was a preemptive strike on Israel by Israel on her neighbors.
And if they were attacking their neighbors in this fashion, they had a reason for doing so. So this is an exemplification of a policy that was in motion, correct?
Correct.
Now, what was that policy?
Well, historically, Israel is like it's an expansionist policy. I mean, we look at how much land has been annexed. We look at the original partition done in by the UN in 1947, the original partition plan. We look at that versus the map of Israel today, where they've expanded, they've taken territory, you know, not just the West Bank and Gaza Strip, which they recently pat themselves on the back for giving, for returning to the Palestinians, even though they're doing incursions and having attacks frequently and extrajudicial assassinations on the people of Gaza. So it's really not like they left. And
hold on for a second. That's a very interesting term. An extrajudicial. Say that again. An extrajudicial.
Extrajudicial assassination.
Okay. How can an assassination be judicial?
Well, there is a process by, you know, which some countries have capital punishment, and so that would be done after a trial. These people are never brought to trial. They're, you know, it's an arbitrary decision on the Israeli government without ever trying, charging, or convicting. Right.
So maybe that's what we should call it, huh?
Sure. Tell that to the mainstream media, too.
Yes, well, but here we can speak the truth.
Great.
I'd like to interject at this point that in 2004, there were two votes in the United Nations General Assembly. They knew... the United Nations knew that if they took it to the Security Council, that the United States would veto any vote that was uncomplimentary to Israel. And the vote condemning the extrajudicial killings and the apartheid wall, two separate votes, were 150-6. Now, of the six that voted negative on condemning Israel, of course, there was Israel itself and the United States, but the other votes were from Australia, the Micronesia, the Marshall Islands, and Palau. Of course, we know about Australia; it has a very strong Zionist movement there. But Marshall Islands, Micronesia, and Palau are all Pacific Island nations, which are fed and clothed and funded by the United States. In fact, I saw on a show of Jon Stewart recently. I'm not sure which show it was. I think it was Jon Stewart. They were interviewing, I think it was the leader of Micronesia. He doesn't even live there. They're appointed by our government as heads of state for these island nations, and then put into the UN, and they vote as they're told.
And that's where that's where they're funded. So in effect, you're saying that the United States has many extra votes in the United Nations.
Exactly.
And how many do you think it has that will simply do whatever they tell them to do?
Well, I don't know. There are many. I mean, if you read Confessions of an Economic Hitman and what the World Bank does, you'll find that part of the process is to make these third world nations indebted to the United States, and part of that indebtedness is to control their vote in the United Nations.
Okay, so that goes into a lot of different other different arenas, of course, which all we know all interconnect.
Correct.
So let's get back to what was going on in Palestine and Israel and the policy that Israel was following that resulted in the war in 67. Because that's clearly there has been a continuity and they're doing the same thing today. But now they're much more they're much further advanced, I assume, in whatever their agenda is.
Let me throw out one point here, which I think is quite interesting. As we all know who have been watching the media recently, Jimmy Carter was condemned for his book about the apartheid in Israel. I, like Tammy, have witnessed the oppressive wall over there and the checkpoints and the militarization of this country. And Jimmy Carter in his book points out that when he was in office, there were 1,500 settlers in these outposts in the West Bank. Tammy, do you know what the current number is of settlers in the West Bank now?
1,500 individuals.
1,500 individuals.
Who were Israelis?
They were Jewish settlers who were going into the West Bank and confiscating land from the Palestinians. And it was, at that time, Israel recognized that this was illegal and wrong. But they allowed this to continue and grow, and as the settlers set up their little outposts, then the Israeli military would come in and protect them. And this expansionist colonialization. But the number, what I want to point out here is the increase in the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think Tammy might have a more current number of the number of illegal settlers there are in the West Bank now.
Mm-hmm. So, do you, Tammy?
I don't have the most recent number, but Dave, if you have the current figure that you have, I imagine it's probably in the tens of thousands.
I've heard nearly a million now. I've heard it's up.
It doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, between.
Wow.
Yeah. But it's huge. I have witnessed it. I've been to Bethlehem as Tammy has, and Bethlehem is now surrounded on three sides by this 30-foot gray monstrous wall, which President Carter so clearly writes about.
Mm-hmm.
And it separates family from family. It separates families from their farmland. It separates kids from their school. And it is so oppressive that it casts a shadow over Bethlehem during most of the day.
Physical shadow.
A physical shadow. Yeah, there are homes right up near the wall. And of course, those who are familiar with what's going on over there know that this is not a security barrier. What it is a land grab, because they have built that wall and the barrier well into Palestine, confiscating great areas of land.
Mm-hmm. And of course, people aren't compensated for their land. They simply take it.
No.
And this has been the policy all along. And this policy actually started in 1948.
Right. I'd like to point out contrast here. If an American citizen were killed anywhere in the world, there would be an outcry, it would make the newspapers, there would be demands for justice. When Rachel Corrie was crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer, a caterpillar bulldozer, gifted to Israel by the United States, there was no outcry. Her congressman, Congressman McDermott in Washington State, tried to bring a resolution to the floor of the House to call for an investigation. It was not allowed.
It was not allowed. Nobody was permitted to discuss it.
Right, right. Any congressman who would have voted to support that would have been paid a heavy price with the Israeli lobby in our country.
Mm-hmm.
I attended a tri-faith conference in North Carolina about 3 years ago to discuss the issues of the Middle East, the Palestine, Israeli issues. Rachel Corrie's mom was there, and for people to come out and condemn Rachel Corrie, it's almost laughable, because nobody represented peace more than Rachel Corey.
Tell us a little bit about Rachel Corey, because I'm sure there are a lot of people who haven't heard and they don't know who she is.
Rachel Corey was a 23-year-old girl from Evergreen University or Evergreen College in Washington State who went over to where was she? I don't know. She was in Gaza.
She was in Rafa refugee camp in Gaza.
Let me let Tammy take it over because she knows
okay,
a little
great.
Bit about it than I do.
Okay, yeah. I'm sure a lot of people still don't know the name Rachel Corey. In fact, when I did a column, which you can now find on my blog, about Rachel on the third anniversary of her death, of her murder. And my editor didn't know anything about it. And he's been in the news business, you know, and he didn't know anything about Rachel Corey. So she was with a group called International Solidarity Movement, and they were trying to stop home demolitions. And when Rachel was murdered, she was standing in front of the home of a pharmacist as an Israeli bulldozer was headed toward it. She was trying to prevent his home from being demolished. And the bulldozer didn't stop. He purposely ran over her. She was wearing, at the time, an orange flak jacket, holding a megaphone. It was a clear day, and they claimed that they didn't see her. The driver of the bulldozer claimed that he didn't see her. And he ran over her. Not only did he run over her, he backed up and ran over her again.
And this wasn't treated as a murder. It wasn't treated as a wrongful death.
It was treated as an accident.
Just an accident.
No charges in Israel were ever pressed against it. He was merely transferred. I believe he was transferred, but never faced any punitive action, and no action, investigative or otherwise, was taken by the United States.
During that time, there were also two other incidents with ISM individuals. One was Brian Avery, who I had the honor of meeting at this conference in North Carolina, this tri-phase conference. Brian was escorting third grade students to class in the occupied territories. He was wearing the international vest, the orange vest, so that the Israeli soldiers would know that he was an American or an international. No weapons. They're strictly for peaceful reasons. And an Israeli soldier shot him in the head and took off the lower part of his face. He's terribly disfigured. He was at this conference after going through many, many, many surgeries, and his life is, you know, he's terribly disfigured, and his life has been altered forever.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Hurdnall was another, a British ISMer who was also there. He was doing the same thing, and was shot in the head and was sent back to Britain, brain dead, and his parents finally removed him from life support.
Mm-hmm.
The British government did demand an investigation, and the soldier who shot him was held responsible. But the United States government, in the case of both Brian Avery, in the case of Rachel Corey, in the case of the USS Liberty, has our representatives, who are supposed to represent us, represent the Israeli interests and not our interests.
Mm-hmm.
So we do not see any accountability of the murder of Rachel or the shooting of Brian Avery or of the attack and murder of the crew members on the USS Liberty.
And so all of these things go to illustrate what's actually happening as opposed to what they say.
Correct.
And this has been the policy that's been in place since 1948.
Absolutely. You know, let me interject one other thing here. I just finished reading Robert Fisk's recent book, The Great War for Civilization. And in that book, he covers the history of the Middle East beginning in the 1900s, but he spent the Israeli-Palestine issue, the hypocrisy of the United States and Britain on these issues when it comes to Israel, and it is really very, very tragic. He has spent a lot of time discussing the atrocities that were committed in Lebanon by the Israelis. When the Israelis invaded Lebanon in the 80s, they attacked, actually the Lebanese army under the control, they were Christian phalangists under the control of Ariel Sharon, who was the defense minister at the time, attacked
mm-hmm.
and murdered over 3,000 refugees in the refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila. Women were raped, the men were murdered. His case, some of the survivors brought charges against Schroen at the International Court at The Hague, and Donald Rumsfeld made a trip to the Netherlands and said, if you go forward with this trial, then we will move our headquarters, or the NATO headquarters, out of Belgium.
Uh-huh.
So the pressure by the United States to silence any condemnation of Israel. By the way, a commission in Israel actually did condemn Sharon for what happened at Sabra and Shatila. It was called the Kahane Commission. You can look it up on the internet and read it.
Mm-hmm.
The Kahane Commission removed Sharon from office and held him responsible for the murders of all of these Palestinian refugees in the camps in Lebanon.
What you're telling is an amazing story. It's a genocide happening right out front, you know, without even the same sorts of, you know, covert behavior you saw in Nazi Germany, and that people try to oppose, and they're silenced.
Correct. I'm a great fan of Robert Fisk, and one of the chapters in his book is called The First Holocaust, and he describes what happened to the Armenians by the Turks, and how they were put into caves, and fires were lit at the mouth of these caves, and the people were suffocated. And this was done over and over again. I mean, it was a Holocaust, but it's not allowed to be referred to as a Holocaust. Again, it's the Turks, with the assistance of the United States, has tried to erase this crime from human consciousness, and in effect allowed only the discussion of one Holocaust, again a horrible Holocaust, but not the only one.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to prevent future Holocausts, we have to recognize all of them for the crimes against humanity that they are, whether it was the one in Germany, or whether it was one in Armenia, whether it was the one in Cambodia, or the ethnic cleansing that's ongoing in Palestine today.
Well, all of these things are, you know, when killing people is not nice. And if you're doing it for policy to clear their land so you can steal it, it's a form of thievery. If you're doing it so that you can grab their securities, as it happened in Nazi Germany. The bottom line remains very clear. What you have is a wealth transfer taking place through death, the death of the people who own the property, in whatever form that expresses itself. So, but you see this happening over a long period of time. Is there a relationship between these different genocides that are being played out in, you know, events today? Because you saw what happened in Nazi Germany. We saw what happened to their Armenians. There's certainly, it looks to me like there could be some common factors. How has big oil played into this?
Well, I think what has happened is Israel has become a surrogate fort in the Middle East for Western aggression for oil resources in the Middle East. As Robert Fisk said, if Iran had cotton or coffee instead of oil, we would not be trying to bring a so-called democracy to the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's how oil ties into this. We have allied ourselves with Israel. We've made Israel the fourth largest military in the world. All gifted by our Congress, who, again, instead of building schools and infrastructure in our country, finds it more beneficial for their own incumbency and special interests to fund the arms merchants and Israel for their own benefit, because it's a quid pro quo. You look at how much of that money comes back to support the elections in this country. Paul Findlay has wrote a book. Paul Findlay was removed from office because he commented that there should be a fair and balanced peace in the Middle East. Howard Dean, when he was at the height of his campaign, married to a Jewish woman, called for a fair and balanced peace in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And he was immediately destroyed by the Israeli lobby.
So they've been very consistent about this, and you have to take a look at, frankly, Israel as real estate and go, it doesn't look that good to me. You'd have thought they'd have been happier asking for a chunk of Germany if it had been a matter of restitution.
Well, I, yeah, again, I don't think you can call it restitution anymore. What we've done is gone from one genocide to where the victims have now become the victimizers.
Well, that's clear, but of course that's the justification that they've tried to use over and over. Though why the Palestinians would have owed them anything is, of course, you know, certainly, shall we say, not clear.
Right.
Well, that goes back to Zionism when Theodore Herzl held the first conference on Zionism. I believe it was like 1898, and they were discussing the possibilities of a Jewish homeland somewhere. And that was in response to the Dreyfus Affair, European anti-Semitism. They wanted to create their own homeland somewhere. Palestine was actually sixth on the list behind places like Argentina and Uganda. And there was little support for Zionism because at first it started out as a secular movement, just basically a homeland for Jewish people. So since there was so little support for it, then Herzl and whoever his, you know, his other followers in the movement decided to play on the emotions of the Torah Jews and went back to the Torah, where it outlines the old boundaries of the ancient kingdom of Israel in the Torah, and wanted to get support for like a religious movement that way, and that's how they started gaining all this additional support and started trying to settle in Palestine. Claiming to have some sort of emotional connection with the land, although that Jews were never prohibited from immigrating to Palestine, but they most of them went to Turkey, Egypt, elsewhere where business conditions were better at the time, and you know, where was the emotional connection there? You know, it looks to me like if many of them had an emotional connection, they would have gone to Palestine and been there all along.
But that's
kind of how the Zionist movement started growing.
Mm-hmm. And it's of course it's important to know exactly what the real origins of the whole movement are, because otherwise the thing makes no sense. If you look at it and you don't understand what the connections are and what the motivations, the human motivations are here, the whole thing is simply bewildering to people. So what we're looking at here, though, from what you just said, is Herzl, you know, there was a strong desire to have a secular Jewish homeland. They couldn't get support for that. And that's happening in pretty much the same period of time when you have the Scofield Bible growing in popularity within the United States, with
exactly.
The underpinnings for what then becomes the Theocon movement.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see some parallels there, because these are both movements that are based on the use of a theology to create a justification for behavior that otherwise would be bizarre.
Absolutely.
And when you take a look at the people who are living in Palestine, who have been impacted by these two different, very different sets of mythologies, very strange cult-like mythologies that have been created very recently, do they understand why this is happening?
Well, there have been the Palestinians are, you know, very educated people, and they do, you know, many of them have studied the belief systems. What many people don't know is that most of the history of Palestinians, what, do you know the exact figure, Dave? I believe it's 80% Muslim and 20% Christian now, even though Christians are fast disappearing from the
I think it's less than that. When I was in Bethlehem the last time, speaking to the person who owned the hotel we were staying in, he commented that most of the Christians, because of the economic distress, are leaving.
Right.
You know, what's happened is with the apartheid walls, trade and commerce are pretty much come to a standstill. In fact, I was reading something today, the average income per Palestinian is less than $2 a day. They're in abject poverty now, and compared to the average income for an Israeli is in the neighborhood of $27,000 a year. So
this goes to a very interesting point, because one of the things I see reiterated over and over is these are people who are uneducated. They have never been what you think of as quote-unquote civilized. And what you just said indicates that that's certainly not true, that they were What was Palestine like before Israel started to move in and simply take it over?
Well, it was, mostly agricultural. I mean, Palestine, a lot of people see from the news and look at it as like a barren place, and they think, I've heard different people comment to me like, well, why would anyone want that? It just looks barren and rocky, and it's that's absolutely not true. Agriculturally, Palestine was completely self-sufficient. I mean, just the agriculture and the springs, the fresh spring water, and they grew everything completely self-sufficient. And then as the Israelis took it over and claimed to have, they even took that verse from the Bible, they make the barren lands become blooming with vegetation and everything. Well, yeah, they commandeered all the water and stole it for their settlements. They control the water. In fact, when I was in Gaza, in Khan Yunis refugee camp, the family I stayed with, all of a sudden I see this little 19-year-old bride. She was a newlywed. She went running down the stairs with a basket of laundry bigger than she was and runs over. And I said, where is she going with that? And what it was, they were having rolling water outages. And she had to run down the stairs with that big laundry basket two streets over to see if her neighbors still had running water so she could finish the laundry. And that's, they've just commandeered it. I saw orange groves with the oranges rotting on the ground because the orange growers aren't allowed to export to anyone but Israel and are paid like a pittance on what the crops are actually worth.
So the commerce is very stiffly controlled. They're not permitted to trade freely.
Right.
In terms of the water rights have been stolen.
Yes.
Because I'm sure that they weren't handed over freely.
Right. One of the things Israel has done is most of the land it confiscated is very fertile land with great water resources. And what they've left for the Palestinians in most cases is arid land without the water resources. And part of the ethnic cleansing, if you've read what the Israelis have done during many of their incursions, they'll go in and poison wells, make the land totally inhabitable, bulldoze olive groves. Just a couple weeks ago, as a matter of fact, there was an international conference in the Palestinian village of Belin in the West Bank, and there were four European ambassadors there, where there were two Nobel laureates there. Uri Avnery was there, Amira Haas, two very famous Jewish writers. I have to interject here that in Israel, there is a voice that condemns Israeli occupation and the oppression of the Palestinians. We're not allowed to have that discussion here. That discussion does happen in Israel, surprisingly enough.
Well, that's rather amazing, but it's a wonderful thing, too.
Right. But at this conference, as soon as the international ambassadors left, the European ambassadors left, the next day the Israeli army came in. They bulldozed the olive orchards. They shot rubber bullets into the crowd. They shot machine gun fire above the heads of the crowd. Water cannons, tear gas. They shot one of the Nobel laureates. And what I found so amazing as I was trying to scan the news to find out what was happening at this conference, there was nothing in the U.S. media, and there never was anything in the U.S. media about this event. But the shooting of a Nobel laureate did make the news in other parts of the world. I found it in New Zealand. I found it in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not allowed to be part of the media discussion in our country. Americans are not allowed to know what goes on.
Yes. That's very clear, and it's happening in all different arenas. I mean, even within the United States, of course, most Americans don't know the Trans-Texas Corridor is taking place.
Right.
They don't know about the North American Union.
Right.
All of these things point back to the presence of a plan that is going forward out in plain sight that simply isn't discussed.
Correct. I mean, you look at the condemnation of Jimmy Carter. Even President Clinton came out a few weeks ago and condemned President Carter's book. Why? To ensure the support of the Israeli lobby for his wife's reelection campaign. 6 months ago when the Israelis Navy shelled a Gaza beach and they killed an entire family. In the aftermath, as the ambulances arrived, somebody had a video camera and took this video of this 10-year-old survivor, one girl of this large extended family, her grandparents, her parents, her siblings, all died. She happened to be in the water at the time of the shelling. This video made it out on the internet, and it shows this girl's overwhelming grief at the loss of her entire family. 10-year-old girl. The Israeli lobby, through the media in this country, did their damage control. A few days later, Krauthammer of the Washington Post does an article, and it refers to the wretched wailing of this girl. Doesn't give her age, doesn't give her name, just the wretched wailing, and gives the presumption or indication that it was not the Israeli Navy that shelled the beach. The British media reported that the Israelis shelled the beach. You can Google this article on the BBC News, and actually they have a link to the video of this poor young girl.
Mm-hmm.
But our media, and Tammy has collected a lot of information on the bias in our media, which I want you to talk about, Tammy.
Yes,
the
please,
bias in our
Tammy.
Media is overwhelming. Go ahead.
Yes, I did a project one time where I collected a series of articles from different newspapers, mainstream media sources, and every time, without exception, any time there was an Israeli shelling, a bombing, an incursion, anything like that, and numbers of Palestinians were killed, in some cases in the teens, I mean like 19, 20, 30 Palestinians killed, it would always receive about a half-inch space on the back of the newspaper under a generic headline called World Headlines. It wouldn't even have its own headline. Yet when there was a suicide bombing in Israel, it would receive front page coverage. You know, we're talking about some cases half a page, big photo accompanying it. And it was this discrepancy collected over a period of a year, and it was without exception.
Mm-hmm.
That Israeli blood is treated as sacred, and Palestinians are animals. I mean, that's how they're treated in the media.
I'll even take it a step farther. When you read these articles, and if for our listeners, just take note. When Palestinian civilians are killed by Israeli incursions, by F-16 bombers or Apache helicopters or Hellfire missiles, you will find that the victims have no names. They have no grieving family members. They are generally referred to as collateral damage associated with Islamic militants. And yet when Israelis are tragically killed by civilians, emphasize civilians, they have names, they have grieving family members, and they have pictures, surprisingly enough.
Mm-hmm.
When the Israelis went into Jenin, I think it was 2002, 2003, I can't remember the exact date, I happened to be overseas at the time, and I picked up three U.S. newspapers, and I picked up three other newspapers from foreign countries. And it was quite interesting because the three U.S. newspapers had a front page picture coverage of the suicide bomber that attacked the bus, and I think there were six Israeli victims there. And in the lower right-hand column, they had a one-inch insert about the alleged atrocities at Jenin. And then the European newspaper, I had a China newspaper, and I had a, can't remember the third newspaper, but they were foreign newspapers. They had exactly the opposite. They had, the front page coverage was about the atrocities in Jenin, about the military incursion, bulldozing homes, missiles going into apartment buildings, refrigeration trucks hauling bodies away. The media was not allowed in. Everything that was reported with the long-range cameras they had on the outskirts of the town. And in the lower right-hand column, they had a one-inch insert about the suicide bus bombing that killed six. But if you're looking at numbers, that would be an appropriate coverage because you're talking about six Israelis being killed versus nearly 100 or more Palestinians being killed.
Mm-hmm.
But we were not allowed to know about what was happening in Jenin.
So you mentioned a group in Israel that's actually objecting to the way Palestinians are being treated. and they're making common cause with Palestinians. Isn't that right?
Oh, yes. Amira Haas lives in the occupied territories with the Palestinians. She happens to be the granddaughter and daughter of Holocaust survivors. And one of the stories that Amira Haas tells, and the reason she is who she is and does what she does, is because her grandmother walked with her mother to the concentration camps in Germany. And her grandmother looked at her daughter, Amira Haas' mother, and said, "How can they stand there and do nothing?" As they walked by the homes with the housefrouws out sipping their tea and hanging their clothes to dry, Amira Haas' grandmother said, "How can they sit there and do nothing?"
Mm-hmm. And so she's not going to sit there and do nothing.
Exactly. And she tells this story. Robert Fisk writes about it. She knows that it's important not to sit there and do nothing. And I think this is why Tammy does what she does and why I do what I do.
Mm-hmm.
We must, you know, the information needs to get out because our media is not doing the job that they should do. They are pawns and controlled by the corporations that are behind all of this.
Mm-hmm. And it is the corporations who are really behind this because they're the ones that profit. I mean, these people created the mythologies, and they use the mythologies, but nobody would have funded them for their mythologies if it hadn't been for the corporations.
Right.
And I know that there are a lot of great people out there trying to do something about this. Could you tell us something about some of those people? We have this woman who's she's a Israeli doing the right thing. Do they come together as a group cooperating with Palestinians and Israelis together?
Well, there are so many. I mean, Alison Ware, who you're aware of, if Americans only knew, Paul Finley, the former congressman. Even Ron Paul speaks about the injustice and blowback of our policies in the Middle East. You know, one of the things I need to get this out, too. One of the misconceptions I run into so frequently is that the Arabs are not very smart, and they're not smart enough to have democracy. And the problem with Americans is they do not know their history. In 1952, Iran had a democratically elected government. They had a president named Mozadegh. He decided he was going to renegotiate his oil contracts with the Brits and the Americans. Well, the Brits and the Americans could not have their corporations making less money, not able to steal as much from the people of Iran. So they went over there. They sent the CIA in there with Kermit Roosevelt, grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, and overthrew the democratically elected government of Iran and installed the Shah, one of the most brutal dictators who ruled with his secret prisons and brutalized his own people with the help of the United States, while we very conveniently continued to get our oil resources from Iran at a very low price. The same thing in Iraq. In 1963, President Kazem was the democratically elected president of Iraq. They had a democracy there. They also had the first medical schools, the first universities of the world were in Iraq.
There's so much that Americans don't know. It's just amazing.
They don't know. One of the doctors, a very older fellow who I used to get my flight physicals from, said the best medical students he ever had, residents, the best residents he ever had came from Iraq.
Well,
came from Baghdad.
We're going to just have to hope that more can be done.
Right.
And I really want to thank you, too, for being here tonight. And we're going to have to get into this some more at another time. So
thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. And
thanks,
I'm going to look forward to that book being written, Tammy.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak here. Thank you.
Okay, you take care. God bless, and we will see you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks. And that's our show for today, Friday, June 8th, 2007. The spiritual politicians we search for the deceit used to grab power, and those always present sneak thieves of freedom that have clogged up our system like hair in the drain of life. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.